our number. We are still wrong. We're up to the Mishnah on Daf Nun Dalet Amud Beis. So we get a very brief break for some a little philosophy here, I guess. And the Mishnah says as follows: Shalos Hazakenim Beromi. They asked the Zakenim in Rome. I mean, it must have been Ziknei Yisrael, Jewish elders in Rome, and the askers, at least according to the Tosefta, the Braisa, the Gemara quotes, were the philosophers, whoever they were. So they asked them, the Zakenim Beromi, Im Ein Ritzono Bavodas Kochavim, Lama Einem Vatla. If God doesn't like Avodah Zarah, if his desire is that we shouldn't worship Avodah Zarah, why doesn't he destroy them? So Amr Lahem, the sages, the elders said to them, perhaps if people only worship those things that the world doesn't really need, then God might in fact destroy them. However, so they serve the sun and the moon and the planets and the constellations. Yovat olamo b'pnei ashotim. He should destroy his world because of these crazy people who do stupid things. So Amr Lahem, then the philosopher said to them, Im Kain, Ya'abe davar she'en tzarach la'olam bo, v'yaniach davar she'otoch la'olam bo. Okay, so God can use a selective zapping. Let him destroy the things that the world doesn't need and leave those things that they do need. So Amr Lahem, if God were to do that, af anu machzikin yidei ovdeyem shel elu she'omrim teidu she'en elahos shereheim labatlu. And if all the Avodah Zarahs, which people worship, that weren't necessary for the world, God would destroy. And he would leave intact the ones which were necessary for the world. So the worshippers of the sun and the moon would say, you see, the Yesh Bahamish. In fact, there's a Rashi and Chumash and Parshas Vayera. When did God destroy Sodom and Amorah? Uchamo HaShachar Allah Vayet. That's the time. So why? So Rashi quotes in the Medrash, because God chose a time when both the sun and the moon were visible. Lest the worshippers of one, you know, if it was during the day, say, if only the moon had been up. Which, interestingly enough, is it's kind of a weird take on Avodah Zarah. Because in that particular story, so if you're a moon worshipper and the moon wasn't up and you got destroyed, firstly, they were all going to be destroyed. So I guess you're talking about the onlookers from the outside. But really, if the moon was really, really the god, so because it's not visible during the day, it's impotent? I think that there's a little bit of an inherent sort of poking fun at Avodah Zarah in the first place, the whole attitude. In other words, they would say it was their god, and yet their god was impotent because he wasn't around. Okay.
So, Shemesh b'gibon dom v'yareach b'emek ha'yalon. So we have the victory associated with the fact that both of them are on.
Okay, yeah, I don't know, you know, how they saw, unless it was in the morning, how they would see both, I don't know, but yes. Okay, so now the Gemara repeats, repeats a little bit, elaborates, Tan Rabbanon, Shalu Filosofim Nesazakeinu Berami. Im Ein Elohechem In Ritzono Avodas Kochavim Ema Ina Mavatla, Amru Lahem, Ilu Davar Sheina Olam Tzarechlo Hayu Ovdim, Harehu Mavatla. But Harein Odom Lacham Olavano B'Kochal Mazalos, Yovar Olam Mnei Ashotim. God should destroy the world. El olam kimin hago nohig. God allows the laws of nature to function. Vishotim shekilkalu asidim litain esadin. And those fools who have been makalkal, who have behaved inappropriately, who have acted destructively, eventually God they'll eventually have to give an accounting. Dover acher.
Minhog avos seim biyodim.
What's that?
You know, minhog avos seim. I will some be a dumb. It is how either. Why are they actually culpable? The ones who worship idols. It's just they're just doing what they were taught.
So that's that's a larger question.
Yeah.
That's a larger question. In other words, the assumption of the Sheva Mitzvos is that Chazal articulated in many cases Hayala Lumod Velo Lamad. So the question would be, what would someone say about a group of people who never encountered in their lives monotheists? Yeah. But in Chazal's context, they would have argued that the pagans were exposed to monotheism and they rejected it. I presume that would be what their argument would be. Dover acher, hareisha gozal sa shel chitim. If a man stole a measure, a saw of chitim, v'halach uzra bekarka, and he goes and he plants it in the ground, dinhu shel titzmach. by right, by the sense of justice, the grain shouldn't grow. El olam kiminhago noheg v'holech v'shotim shekilkalu asidim litenes adin. And finally, the third example, davar acher, harei shabal eishas chaveiro. So a man has an affair with a married woman. Din hu shelo tisaber. By right, she should not become pregnant. The natural outcome of the act, though probably the adulterers didn't intend that either, they might be happy, was that she should not become pregnant, because it's a wrong thing. El olam kiminago noheg v'holech v'shotim shekilkalu asidim litenes adin. And regarding the last one, Vahinu da Amar Reish Lakish, Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Lo Dayan L'Rishon She'osin Shela Shali Pumbi, Ela Shematrichan Osi U'machtimin Osi Ba'al Korchi. So Reish Lakish says, it's not just, in other words, God says, it's bad enough that the wicked people make my Sela Hefker, but they force me, in effect, to seal on it. In other words, the assumption is a human being is engraved with the image of God. So it's bad enough that the Rishayim disobey God, but when they, in fact, have an affair and create a child from an adulterous affair, they are, in effect, forcing God's hand to put his stamp upon the Vlad, to put his seal upon the Vlad, to create another human being in the image of God, even though it's being done pa'avera. Okay. So the answer to the philosophers is really, the first answer was, it would be impossible for God to do so. The other answers are, it's actually not so. In other words, the first Davar Acher, at least, is, no, it's not that God would have no choice. It's that that's just not the way God runs his world. People do bad things, and the natural consequences that follow from those bad things happen, whether it's good or bad things. In the case of the wheat, presumably, if you plant the wheat, you want it to grow. And that's the way God lets the world work. And eventually he collects from the people who need to be collected from. Obviously, in a certain sense, there's a hidden in this is a little bit of a response or the Chazal's thinking about theodicy. Right? And this is not about somebody who suffered and then, you know, eventually gets paid back, or the wicked eventually get punished for causing their suffering. This is just about people who did bad things. God lets the world function the way the world normally functions, and later, ultimately, everybody gives an accounting.
Is this unique in Ch'as, this type of philosophical discussion?
No. The earlier one wasn't really a philosophical discussion. Someone asked Rabbi Gamliel in the bathhouse, how can you bathe here? That was more of a halachic discussion, but this is not the only philosophical discussion, I'm pretty sure. You can find others. We had Rebbe and Antoninus in the first parak about when is God put a neshama in the child and so on. So you have various kinds of these discussions going on.
So this whole thing is the concept really follows consistently that Hashem is not Mishana Es HaTeva.
Right.
Right.
That's correct. Right. That's God. You know, God doesn't. Right. There's a.
That's complicated.
It's all very complicated.
Then prayer has right. If God doesn't intervene.
So the question is, in a natural or unnatural fashion, you know, I say it's above my pay grade. I'm not sure whose pay grade it's in, but the way there's a range of opinions, of Rishonim worth noting on this. I mean, the Rambam is an extreme. The Rambam and the Mora, at least, would seem that prayer really doesn't have an effect, doesn't change God, but rather it has an impact upon the prayer himself or herself, but I don't think that that's the way. I don't think that's the way Chazal thought about it.
It's not consistent with even some of the tefillos we have, right?
Correct. The whole theme of in Tanakh and in Chazal, the way we daven, doesn't really sound like the Rambam. The question
even more challenging.
What? Correct. Correct. But what I would say is that I think that Chazal's assumption is that God will never explicitly change. You know, we'll never, under ordinary circumstances, does not perform, I'll call a nes nigla. Correct, as a general rule.
Right.
And what I would say is that part of the problem, you know, the Pasuk in Kabbalah says, v'yosif da'as yosif machov, right? Ki barov chachma rav ka'as, the greater knowledge, the greater the anger, the greater the suffering. But I would frame the following. We daven for rain sometimes. We did recently in Eretz Yisrael when they were missing rain. Now, it happens to be the weather prediction systems right now are far from perfect, you know, as we know. All right, they're pretty good. I mean, they are pretty good. We have to, you know, we have come to the expectation that if the weather's forecasters say there'll be 3 to 5 inches of snow, we expect there'll be 3 to 5 inches of snow. If the storm blows off a little bit, so the snow came, you know, a few miles to the east, a few miles to the west, and how can these people get things straight? But if you think about the, compared to 200 years ago, the level of accuracy, weather prediction, even 5 days out, is astounding, right? It really is. But it's not precise. We know that, you know, things can go off. And if you move to 10 days already, you know, sometimes it bears resemblance, general trends, but sometimes things just go totally awry. So the question is, what if we predict, so you can always daven for rain, and it's not a tefillah shav, because things do sometimes have been a funny way. But what if we were to develop weather prediction systems and model them that they could take into account when the bird flaps its wings and change the thing, and we could get really exact weather pattern for the next 5 days? Would it be permissible to pray for rain during those 5 days? Number one would be a tefillah shav. And number two, let's put that question aside. At this point, for God to bring rain would require explicitly intervening in the laws of nature where we can see it. Will God do that? And my assumption has always been, perhaps it's theologically very unsophisticated, is that God will not intervene in a way that's obvious to human beings, and that could be obviously discerned. Which means that the more knowledge we acquire, the more we push God out of the physical universe. It's a little disconcerting, but we face this issue. Look, you're a doctor. I mean, maybe this is not exactly the field of medicine, but doctors will look at patients with certain conditions, and they know. They'll say, you have, you know, a month to live, 3 months to 6 months to live. Once in a blue moon.
One in 100.
Yeah, 100. So that doesn't happen that way, you know, or as the joke goes, especially when, you know, when he starts to pay the doctor's bills. So, you know, the old line, well, you have a month to live, and I can't pay the bills. Okay, you have 6 months. But the bottom line is, so what is the purpose of prayer? I mean, you could pray for a good death, you could pray for lesser suffering, and so on, but I think people still sort of pray for a miracle. Now, sometimes they happen, you know, and those who stand in the medical profession, sometimes they're stunned, sometimes they'll say something happened in the body, all of a sudden the immune system woke up and decided to attack it, and so on. The more we know, the harder it is to pray, right? Whether it's mut or us is a separate question, but it's hard to pray because you in effect know what the outcome is, and now the question is, you can change your attitude towards the outcome, but you can't. God can change it. We believe in theory it could change the outcome, but we don't typically ask for that. So it really makes life, that's why I say, ki baruch chachma rav kas yosef dasach yosef machov, or, you know, as the line in Shakespeare goes, sometimes ignorance is bliss. But that's, it's a little tricky. Okay, so anyway, so now the Gemara continues. The Gemara continues.
More than a little tricky.
What's that?
It's more than a little tricky.
I know. I know. I know. Sometimes, you know, it's a problem. One of the problems our community experiences is that we don't, ourselves and our children, we don't talk about God. But sometimes there's a reason why we don't talk about God. I think most of us are uncomfortable with a relationship with God, which is unfortunate. I think it's incredibly unfortunate. But part of the reason we don't do it is because we're uncomfortable with, in certain parts of the from world, people are perfectly comfortable, you know, speaking about how God works in the world, how God does this. Yeah. After the fact, they tell stories. Granted, they talk about the person who missed their connecting flight and the plane crashed. They never talk about the person whose first flight came in early and they got on the earlier flight instead of having to wait later so they could see their family sooner, and then they got on that plane that crashed. Nobody likes to talk about that side. They only like, for the most part, they only like the feel-good side, which is not a very consistent God, if you want to put it that way. But I think that in some communities, in some parts of our world, people are very comfortable, you know, selectively seeing the hand of God when it sort of suits their message or makes them feel better, and I understand that. I'm not saying that judgmentally or critically, but I think that we are uber intellectuals, or we see ourselves as that, and it's very hard for us to sort of live with this not consistent intellectual picture of God. And I'm not advocating we do that. I really am opposed to saying that we can see. It's not because I don't think God's hand might be there. I don't think we should be in the business of finding God's hand and how things happen. But I think there's a loss when we don't talk about a personal relationship with God. So,
because you're going to get to a point where you can't explain God.
Correct. Look, you're faced.
There
are two schools of thought within Jewish philosophy, and they may be a range, not two points of hashkacha pratis and lack of hashkacha pratis. I'm going to talk about hashkacha klolis now. But do you believe that the world works with hashkacha pratis or not? It happens to be that most major philosophical rishonim did not subscribe to hashkacha pratis. Right? If they did, it was in an extremely limited fashion. Of the major philosophical rishonim that I know, the Ramban might be the only one who says something, and it's not clear what he actually holds, because he seems to contradict himself in different places. But Chazal themselves weren't of one mind on this. You have, you know, to pick two agados that I think highlight the opposite poles. On the one hand, there's a Gemara, I think, in Chulin in the first parak, that Ein Adam Nokef Etzbo Milmata Alam Ken Gazo Alam Mala. You don't stub your finger below unless they decreed upon you upon high. On the other hand, the Gemara in the Avela Sugyas near the end of Moed Katan says that there are three things that are Lav Bezchusa Talya Milse Alav Mazal Talya Milse. They're not dependent upon your merits, they're just dependent upon Mazal, which is, I think, Mizone Ubane, right? The length of life, one's Parnassa, and children. And they give examples of two Amoraim, one who had incredible mazel, two big tzaddikim, and one who, you know, one who had 100 children, one who buried 100 children, etc., that kind of a thing. And you can't explain it based upon whether what they deserved, what they didn't deserve. You know, the advantage of adopting Ashkacha Pratis position is that it's very comforting at many times, and you feel God is with you, and so on. The downside is that you have to explain theodicy, and it becomes very hard to explain. If you say Olam Kiminhago Noeg, as the Gemara does here, V'Rasharim Shekilkulu Asidim Litan Esadin, then okay, maybe this is not the way I want the world to run, but I understand. God lets the world run by the laws of nature. Bad people do bad things. Good people suffer, because that's often what happens. And the Cheshbon is fixed at some later point, maybe in the Olam Emes. What's that?
They pay an ultimate price.
Right. So that's the, you know, the downside to it is that basically you have to go through the world, I think, with a sense of that you serve God not because it's going to make your life better, but because it's the right thing to do. You serve God right, which is what we're supposed to do, but that's very hard for people to live with. And that's very, very difficult for people to do. Right? It's hard to say. It's hard. We don't really buy into the notion of servitude so well. Right? We don't believe in avdus anymore. I think all of us were glad that slavery is gone. But we are God's. We may use the term servant, but yeah, we are His avadim, and avid is a slave. God tells us to do it. We do it. Is God going to make our life better? It doesn't matter. We do it because, you know, al karcha chata notzar, al karcha chata nivra, the al karcha chata nolad, al karcha chata meis, al karcha chata litein din cheshbon, you know, the misha amar v'ha'yolam. But that's not an easy sell. That's not an easy sell for people. So, okay.
That's why Hasidus really succeeded, because it gave that personal love and that personal allegiance.
But I don't know if that's
and
because
he
of...
he was able to do it.
I don't know if that's because of the way of looking at the Ribbono Shel Olam. I think that the Rebbe, in certain ways, took care of his Hasidim. I think before the advent of Hasidus, so if you weren't anybody, you weren't anybody. If you were a Gvir, or you were Talmud Chacham, you know, if you were a Gvir, the Talmud Chachamim, you know, showed deference to you and took care of you. But if you weren't, it was stultifying for many people and so on. I think that actually the success of Hasid, the ultimate success is Chabad. And Chabad understands that if you take care of people, then they become your Hasidim in their own way. Okay.
Right, in various ways.
All right, so now the Gemara continues with a similar story, but Shal Philosophis Echad is Rabban Gamliel. Kosov b'toraschem, ki Hashem Elokecha eish ha'ochlahu elkano. God is a jealous God. So he asked, neima miskane be'ovdeha ve'ein miskane ba. Why does God get angry at the worshippers and not angry at the Avodah Zarah? Amar lo, em shalachal mashal. Let me give you a parable. L'mah davar domer, l'melech basar v'dam, shehaya lo bein echad. The king had a son, v'oso abein hayimagada lo asa kelef. The son had a dog. V'hela lo shem al shem aviv. So his father was Richard. He called his dog Richard. U'chashunishpa omer b'chaye kelev abba. So k'shashama hamelech, when the king heard, al mihu koes, al abein hu koes, al kelev hu koes. Who do you get angry at, the son or the dog? Have a Omer Alabenu Kois. So the same thing. The Avodah Zarah is not doing anything. It's the Obed Avodah Zarah. That's who God gets angry at. The question and the answer itself, you know, reveal something interesting, right? The philosopher is asking from the vantage point that this God is a God. And the Emor Megamliel is responding from the vantage point of the God is not a God. That's why God doesn't get angry at it. He's nothing to be jealous of a non-God. He gets angry at the people who are worshipping it. Okay, so then, this part I have to admit I had trouble understanding. Amar lo, the philosopher says to Rabban Gamliel, Kelevata kore osa, you call it a dog, that's what the Avodah Zarah is, that's your mashal? V'halo yesh ba'mamish. This Avodah Zarah is actually, it works, it is, he does have power. So, umara isa, He says, why do you think that this God has power? Amar lo pamachas nafla dleka b'irenu v'nisrafa kola ir kula v'oso beis avodas kolchavim lo nisraf. Every house burned except for that house that they have avodas zara. Okay. So it's not clear. I don't know what. There's something going on here, and I don't know what it is. And the Rishonim have virtually. Rashi has almost nothing to say, and the other Rishonim certainly have nothing to say. This is not a question of the truth, but there's something going on here. The Ovedei Avodah Zarah, the philosopher's response is very strange. Kelavata Koreosa, and then launches and tells a story in which one Avodah Zarah was. The house didn't burn down. And then Rabbi Gamliel comes back with another mashal, and it's not clear. What is he? Amar lo, em shalucha mashal. Lema davar dome. Lemelech basar vadam, shesarcha alav medina. So a province rebelled against the king. Keshu osa mochama imachayim hu osa, o hu mamesim hu osa. Does he fight against the living? Does he fight against the dead? Have a omer imachayim hu osa. So amar le, so now the philosopher responds, kelevata koreosa? Mesata koreosa? You call it also a dead thing? Im king, abdena min ha'olam. Why doesn't God destroy it? Amar lo, il ladavar shena olam tsarach lo, ha'yu ovdim, harei mevatla. As we saw in the Mishnah and in the first brisa. Harehin ovdim lachama ulavana lakochavim ulamazalos, laafikim ulageayos. Laafikim are springs of water, like haafikim banegev, and geayos are hills. Ya'abed olamo me shotim? He should destroy the world because of the shotim. V'cheinu omer, similarly he reads, and this is that reads from the pasuk in Sefania, asof asef kol me'al panei adama nu'um Hashem, asef adam uvema asef ov Hashemayim edgeayam v'amach shelos es harishayim. Now when we read the pasukim, I think according to Pshat, God is indicating that he is going to destroy all of these things. He's going to destroy everything from the face of the earth, the people, the animals, the birds, the fish, and so on. But the way the Gemara reads it, as Rashi points out, is bithmia. Asof asef kol me'al panei adama nu Hashem. Asef adam uvema asef ov Hashemayim edgeayam. V'chmei ma nilchem ipnei sha'arishayim nichshalim bohem. Ya'abdei min ha'olam. V'halola adam him omdim. People serve other human beings. V'chratias adam me'al panei ha'adama. So that's an interesting read of the Pesukim. That's in the Pesukim in Sefania, but that's what the Rabbi Gamliel concludes with here. Which is, God doesn't destroy the Avodah Zarah because many of the things that people worship are actually very important and useful things. Okay.
They're
now,
useful.
What's that?
Socially useful. Yeah, they're saying that there is a value that exists outside of faith.
I don't think that's a chiddush, but the world wouldn't survive without these things.
That's correct.
Okay.
This is a socialist view.
Fine. Shal Agrippa Sartzavo as Rabban Gamliel. So Rashi says he was a Roman in the time of Agrippas HaMelech, but that's not the same Agrippas.
No.
He asked them the following: Simisoraschem ki Hashem el kecha esho chlahu kel kana klum miskane elachacham b'chacham b'gibor b'gibor v'asher b'asher. Right? People don't become envious. If Avodah Zarah is impotent and worthless, why does God get jealous of it? It's nothing to be jealous of. He's not threatened by it. Right, a chacham is threatened by someone else who's very smart, etc. So Amar lo em shalacha mashal lama hadavar dome. Okay, la adam shenasa. I'm not sure. It would be interesting to hear the woman's opinion on this, but this is the way the Gemara presents it. The mashal is adam shenasa ishal ishto chashuva mimena ein miskanaba pchusim mimena miskanaba. A man takes a second wife. So if she's more chashuva than the first wife doesn't get upset. If she's less chashuva than the first wife, she gets annoyed. Why? Because I understood, you know, if you took X, you know, as your second wife, fine, I'm not X, but you took this nothing, you took, I'm not good enough for you, but this nothing, you know, I ain't okay, me needs, okay. That's an interesting perspective. I don't know, haven't done a survey to see how content in the Me Too world how it would respond. I don't suggest going home and taking a poll though.
I have a case of that just right now. It's on the surface. The woman is complaining. How could he take such a trash? You know, so to speak.
Okay.
The second, you know,
he remarried.
He took up with another woman.
Okay.
And the point was that the woman is
sort of much lower class.
Right.
How could he do it?
Interesting.
I mean, that's on the surface. I mean,
right, correct. Well, the question is, you want to know what would it have been if he took up with someone who was...
She's saying if he took someone that was...
I got it. I got it. Okay.
She could understand it.
Right. But for this? That's
why is he giving this one? She's at least
a... It means okay. Her. It means her that...
Yeah.
I got it. I understand. Okay. There you go. All right. So then...
So what's your advice?
It's still an ongoing process. I
mean, okay.
Here comes the end of the story one day.
But there's still the implication that there's a God. The Avodah Zarah is more than just an inanimate.
Well, no, because the Avodah Zarah could be a zero. Right? The whole point is if the Avodah Zarah were efficacious, then maybe God wouldn't get so upset. I understand why you're turning to it. But this thing is totally worthless. It's a zero. It doesn't do anything. And that's, in other words, it's a little bit like Yirmiyahu's comment, which Sam touches a little bit sort of what you were asking about earlier, people just following their ancestral practices. Yirmiyahu criticizes the people, double-edged sword. He says, Ha-hemir goy Elohim, ve-hem alo Elohim, va-mi hemir kvodo belo ya'il. Right? Nations don't give up on their gods. And they're not gods. They're worthless. And my nation, you know, so he says earlier, Kishtaim ra'os asa'ami. They did two evil things. Osi azvu, Mikar Maim Chayim, Lachtsov Lahem Boros, Boros Nishmarim Ashelachinamayim. They abandoned me, and every nation doesn't abandon its gods. On top of that, they abandon, you know, Be'er Maim Chayim for Boros Nishmarim, for empty pits. Right? So there is, Yirmiyahu does express a certain kind of value, A, to loyalty, even if the Yoth is nonsense, on top of which you abandon it for garbage, for nothing. Okay. What's that?
Larry can quote her Yirmiyahu. The poem goes back thousands of years.
There you go.
She has a source.
Okay. Amar le Zunin l'Rabbi Akiva. Rashi says Zunin was a Jew. Libi v'litcha yada avodat kochavim les b'mashasha. We both know that avodah zarah is, there's no reality to it, no substance to it. But v'haka chazinan gavrei the azli ki mitabre v'asu ki mitzamde. This sounds almost like Jesus healing the sick, the lame, and so on. They go to the Beis Avodah Zarah when they are broken, mitabre, and they come back when they are mitzamdeh, means they've been somewhat, they've been put together, like at Samid Pasil. So how do you explain that? So my time of Omer lo, em shalach al-mashal, lema hadavar domer, la'adam ne'man shahaya be'ir. You have a person who's very trusted by the townspeople. And people would give him stuff to watch, and they didn't ask for her seat, they didn't ask for, you know, for witnesses. They trusted him. Ubo Adam Echad comes along one person, v'hifkid lo be'edim. And he gave it with edim, which is insulting in a certain way. Pam Echad, shachach v'hifkid etzlo shelo be'edim. He forgot the guy, and he gave it edim. Amra lo ishto, with the wife of the shomer, says to him, "Bova nachbarenu. Let's deny he ever gave it to us because we could wouldn't win that taina. Right? Everybody else, it's harder to make that taina because they always give us witnesses. They've trusted us." So Amar lo, he says to his wife, "Vechi mipnei sheshota zeh, asa shaloka hoden anu na'abed es amunaseinu, because he behaved in an inappropriate fashion, we should forfeit our trustworthiness." Afkach yisurim b'shar shemeshagrin osan ala adam. When God sends a suffering upon a person, mashbiyin osan, the yisurim are personified here, they abjure them, they impose an oath upon the yisurim. Shlo tochu ela biyom ploni, velo teitzu ela biyom ploni, v'shar plonis v'ayidei ploni, v'ayidei sam ploni. In other words, they give an instruction, you stay until this day, till that day, till he takes this medicine, till this person heals him, and then you leave the person. So, Kevan shigias manon latzes, when that appointed time reached, then the Yisurin are supposed to leave. Halach zel lebeis avodas kochavim. This guy now goes and worships Avodah Zarah. Amru Yisurin, the Yisurin say, dinu shalonetze, by right, we shouldn't leave him now, because now he's done something terrible. V'chosim v'omru, but then they turn around and say, v'chi b'pnei sheshota zeh osa shalok kahogen, anu na'abed shfuaseinu. God commanded us to do X, that's what we do. Right? Because he went and chose on the day that was the appointed time that his suffering should cease, and he goes and does a big avera, we're not going to obey our shlichus? No. And Amar and Vahainu da Amar Rabbi Yochanan, my desiv v'chalayim ra'im v'nemonim. It's an interesting expression. V'hifla Hashemis at the end of the Tochacha, near the end of the Tochacha, in Parshas Kisavo, V'hifla Hashemis makosecha v'eis makos zarecha makos gedolos v'nemonos v'chalayim ra'im v'nemonim. So what does it mean to be, we understand what chalayim ra'im is. What is nemonim? Trustworthy, faithful. So, b'chalayim ra'im v'nemonim, ra'im b'shlichusam, v'nemonim b'shfuasan. Right, they are faithful to God's instructions. Okay. So, one of the interesting things that does emerge out of this Agada, on a totally side note, which is interesting, is there's a halacha the Rambam quotes that you're not allowed to lend somebody money without witnesses. The reason you're not allowed to lend money somebody without witnesses is because it's a violation of lifnei iver lo sitein mishal. Because the person's going to forget, the person's going to get confused, and they're going to end up denying owing you the money. Right? Which is true as a good, it's good business practice. It's a good business practice, both from a moral perspective, from a practical perspective. When people do things, everything should be done, you know, in writing. It should be properly recorded. So that there's no, because sometimes people, innocently, they misremember things, right? And therefore, when you put everything down and you sign them, everybody knows exactly what the terms are. I have a friend who's, I mean, this is not even about memory. I have a friend who was family was in the diamond business, and what he said to me is whenever they entered into partnership, they worked out the detail, all the details of the breakup were worked out then, right? When everything is set down very, very, very clearly, there's a little room for confusion, there's a little room for fighting, and so on. It makes for a much better relationship, and in this case, the same thing is true with a loan. It eliminates the possibility of making a mistake. It eliminates the possibility someone is pressed and they decide to lie, and to do so without Edom is a violation of lifnei iver lo sitein mishal. So it's interesting that that here the Gemara presents this, and I don't think the din applies by a pikadon. If I give you something to watch, I don't need Edom for that. I suspect that the question is, why not? Why aren't you afraid exactly what this person's wife was doing? I think the answer is that one of the major concerns by a loan is not simply someone who's outright lying, but someone who's getting confused. So how much money did you lend me? What were the terms of the loan? And so on and so forth. So that can really vary from thing to thing. When I give you an object to watch, you can, if you're basically a dishonest person, you can say, you never gave it to me, and you can be coercion. But outside of that, there's very little room for confusion. Right, you give me the object to watch. When the term is over, I get back to you. That's the object is the object. I know that I'm not supposed to use your object, and so on and so forth. It's not. It's given for me to watch. So that may be why there's much less of a concern there, and we wouldn't say that there's an isser of being mafkid with someone shelo be'ed. Okay, the Gemara continues on this theme. Amar le Rava bar Rav Yitzchak le Rabbi Yehuda, ha'ika beis avodas kochavim ba'asrin. There's a base avodah zarah in our town. The chimitzrich alma lemitra, when the world needs rain, mitach siluhu bechelma. He comes to someone in a dream, to them in a dream. Va'amar lehu, and he says to them, shachatu li gavra va'aisi mitra. Slaughter for me a person, and I'll bring rain. Shachatu le gavra va'aisi mitra, and they slaughter a person, and rain comes. Amar le, Rabbi Yehuda said to him, hashta ihava shachivna lo amri lehu hamilsa. Had I died, I would never have been able to tell you the following interpretation. The Amar Rav, Mai Dichsiv Asher Chalak Hashem Elokecho Sam L'chol Hamim. So this verse actually is from a theological vantage point, from a rabbinic vantage point, is a little bit disturbing. Because the Torah says that you're not supposed to, you know, stray after these things. Asher Chalak Hashem Elokecho Sam L'chol Hamim Shatachas Kal Shemayim. So it sounds as if God has actually given the Gentiles permission to have Avodah Zarah. In other words, our portion is God. Ki Chelak Hashem Amo. I'm inverting that. That's the reverse. We're His Chelak. But basically, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is our job to worship. And the Goyim, God gave them the sun, the moon, the stars, all the forces, nature. They're free to worship those things. But that's not what Chazal believe. Chazal believe that one of the Sheva Mitzvot B'nai Noach is in fact Avodah Zarah. So B'nai Noach is also not allowed to worship those things. So here the Gemara quotes a Drasha. Rashi also quotes a slightly different version of this in Chumash from the story of the Septuagint. Right? One of the changes they made in the Septuagint, according to the Gemara, was Asher Chalak Hashem Elokecha Osam l'chol ha'amim l'ha'ir, in order to give off light. Because otherwise, in the context of Avodah Zarah, you shouldn't worship these things that God apportioned to the nations, so it sounds like He gave it to them to worship. So here the Gemara has a slightly different version of this. Asher chalak Hashem el'chach osam l'chol ha'amim, malameit shechlikam bedvarim kedei l'tardam min ha'olam. that God basically gave them place to slip up. Right, that's what chalak means. You do have this as a biblical Hebrew word as well, right? Chalak lakos, which means someone who is deceitful or tricky or something like that. So asher chalak here doesn't mean to apportion, but it means to make slippery for the nations of the world. Now, at the first glance, that seems to be a different theologically problematic, in a different way theologically, from what we saw at the beginning of the Masechta a good number of years ago, which was when the nations come to God and say, "Give us another chance." And he gives them the mitzvah sukkah, and then God brings out the sun and bakes it on them. So the Gemara asks, "V'ha'ina kadosh baruch hu ba'betronya in briyosa." God doesn't look to find fault or to make us trip up and so on. So, but that's what it sounds like here. He gave it to them hechlikon. So v'ha'inu the amreish lakish ma'idasiv emalitzim hu yalitzvel and avim yitein chayin. That to the scorners God will mock, but to the humble He will give favor. So this is actually very different. In other words, if someone comes to do something wrong, God will allow him to do so. If someone comes to do something right, God will even assist him in doing so. So the point is, it's not that God did this so to trip them up. God let Nasasher Chalak means He let them go astray. He didn't do it so that they would go astray, but if they were disinclined to be monotheists and to seek God in that way, God said, "Fine, you want to go? I'm giving you those things. The world needs them for light. You want to go astray after them? That's your problem, not mine." Okay, so that's what he said. That God sometimes allows things to happen. Let's put it that way. He brought rain. We would say, based upon the previous Gemaras, it was time for rain to come. But he lets things happen. The fact that it's going to be, God is not going to withhold the rain immediately after this, so that the worshippers will therefore not think that it was this Avodah Zarah that brought down the rain. God is going to do his thing, and sometimes by letting the rules of nature, work. So things that can be misleading for people, that's the way it is.
Welcome, Shadam Rotzaleh.
Right, Bamali Chanosa.
Let me ask, I think if Marshall were here, he would say that this kind of thinking doesn't hold today. That is, if somebody is if you need rain, if you slaughter somebody or do something, that's a means of getting rain and so on. And if you act this way, it's going to be good, and if you act the other way, it's going to be bad. According to Hashem, we wouldn't think of it that way unless you view it as a medrash, It doesn't seem to fit our senses in terms of...
Well, correct. But I don't know that that's true, actually. I think that there are large, large parts of the world. I think we fall prey here to what, Jonathan Haidt of The Righteous Mind would say, we're very weird. We're Western educated, intellectual, rich, and democratic. And 99% of the world and large parts of this country do not think the way. I'm not saying maybe not everybody in this room fits that description, will call himself a liberal, but in that sense, even the conservatives within our community and so on still look the many ways sort of like that lens. But when you go to most of the world, again, we may recoil when you hear a great rabbi get up and say that, Hurricane Katrina came because of the gays in New Orleans. But there's a large part of the world, maybe most of the world, maybe 95 or more percent of the world, that actually find, they might disagree with the details, but think that way of thinking is perfectly reasonable and accurate. So you're right. In other words, we may not think that way. We may style ourselves, maybe we are, maybe we're not, as sophisticated and more sophisticated than that. But I think this probably represents the way most people think. I think so. And even today.
They imagine.
Even today. So it's not an endorsement or a criticism. It's just a description. So, but Chazal did have to respond to that because, look, sometimes things line up the wrong way. So you have to explain why. The answer is, because it happened that way, not because God planned, wasn't part of God's plan, which is their answer here. Okay. So now we begin what might be the last, major chunk of the Masechta with a few sub-pieces that we did already, the actually Hechsher Kalim at the end. We now come on to the topic of wine. What is wine? It's an important question. So wine is a liquid that is squeezed out of grapes. Okay. I know that's pretty obvious. But what's the question I'm really asking? Is every liquid squeezed out of grapes at every point, is that considered wine or not? Now, for starters, we know something from what we learned earlier in the Masechta, that if someone squeezed the liquid out and then the liquid turned into vinegar, that's not wine. Now, it would happen to be that if the wine were us, there was a stage that it was, which it was wine, and if at that stage it became Yayin Nesach, the fact that it turns into vinegar doesn't change its status. We know that there's wine that you can do things to that make it no longer wine for the purposes of Yayin Nesach. You can be mevashalit. There's a question we discussed in the third parak about Giloy. What if the wine became uncovered? Is it still Shayach? I think to be Yayin Nesach. Okay, but certainly the Yayin Mevushal, you know, we assume does not become Yayin Nesach. Cannot become Yayin Nesach once it's Mevushal. The question that this Mishnah is actually going to deal with is sort of the opposite end. When does something become wine? In other words, I squeeze the grapes. But if I squeeze the grapes, let's say in a vat, so the liquid starts to accumulate. Now, the way they would have done things is you would have had a vat, and then you would have had a place where typically where the liquid could sort of spill off, spill over into a bore, into a kli. I shouldn't use the term vat. You have a pressing area. And then the liquid may siphon off or flow off into, I'll call it the vat, whatever form it has. And the question is, at what stage is it considered wine? Now, the question of whether something is considered wine has ramifications not only for Avodah Zarah, that's one case, but there's at least another major, there are other areas in halacha that ostensibly are also subject to this, to something that's very halacha lamaisa, but probably not so relevant in this context. For the purposes of mitzvahs that require wine, when does it have the status of wine? You'll see why that may turn out to be irrelevant, because once you take it out of the vat, it almost certainly may be wine. But the question is, what stage in that process is it wine? Or another example the Gemara is almost immediately going to deal with is the question of trumos and maisros. The Torah mandates explicitly, at least only, and according to many Rishonim, most Rishonim only, that there are three substances at which you have to remove trumos and maisros from. And all other substances, the obligation of trumos and maisros, even in Eretz Yisrael, is only rabbinic in nature. Those three things are dagon, tirosh, and yitzar. What are those three things? So the typically dagon is translated as grain. It means one of the five species. One of the five, I would say, glutinous species of grain. Tirosh is assumed to be wine or grapes, and yitzar is assumed to be oil or olives, olive oil or olives themselves. Now, and also, except for the Rambam, almost all Rishonim assume that all other peiros ha'ilan, are only obligated in trumas and maisos midrabbanon, not midoraisa. And everybody says that the trumas and maisos from vegetables, from yirakos, and at least one fruit, even the Rambam agrees, charuvim, bakser, so the trumas and maisos are only derabbanon. But working with the opinion of most Rishonim, so dagon, tirosh, and yitzar are chayiv midoraisa and trumas and maisos. But the question is, what exactly, I know what species they come from, what exactly is dagon, tirosh, for yitzar? So there, we do know that typically speaking, they would separate trumas and maisros only after they had finished processing. And what did they typically do with these various agricultural entities with these kind of produce? Well, dagon, they would harvest the grain, they would thresh it, they would winnow it, and they would at least finish. The first stage at which you might get stuff that you might eat and roast would be if you had a pile of kernels. Okay, I'm going to come back to that, but that's what typically was done with the grain. And in fact, the word dagon, I believe, although I think the linguists have missed this, the word dagon actually means pile. I say that because the Aramaic word for pile is digora, dalid gimel resh. Like yigar, and yigar doesn't have the dalet, but yigar, sahadusa, and bracious, right, is gal aid. The Aramaic, the Targumim use the word digora, dalid gimel resh. And resh and nun are both liquid consonants. It's clear to me dagon and digora are cognate with one another. And dagon means the pile of grain. Now, I have a proof from that from Chazal as well. There is a sugya in multiple places in Shas, which discusses the following question. You're supposed to separate truma first, give it to the Kohen. Then you separate Maisa Rishon, you give it to the Levi. From the Maisa Rishon, the Levi gives 10% to the Kohen. The original amount of truma is anything you want, but let's say 2% is the average number we typically give. What happens if before you separate truma from a pile of grain, the Levi comes along and gets you to separate Meiser? Okay, so the Meiser comes Meiser. He has to give Trumas Meiser to the Kohen, but the question is, before he gives the Trumas Meiser to the Kohen, does the Levi first have to separate regular truma, even whatever percentage, 2%, let's say, and give that to the Kohen, and then separate Trumas Meiser? Or do you say no, that once the Meiser Rishon was taken out, you don't have to separate Truma Gedola, only Trumas Meiser? So Abaye explained to Rav Papa the following, that there's a distinction between two different cases. One case is if the Levi was makdim the Kohen. He beat the Kohen out bashibalim, when the grain is still in stalks. It's still in bundles. In that case, the Levi only has to separate Trumas Meiser. If, however, Hikdimo Bakri, if it was already a pile of kernels that had been processed, then the Gemara says he has to separate first Truma Gadol, the Levi does, and then Trumas Meiser. Then he asked, Papa asked Abai, why the difference? Abai says to him, Hai Idgan, V'hai Lo Idgan. Right? One was turned into Dagan, one wasn't. Literally, if I want to translate that. Istagan and Lo Istagan. That means Dagan, means one was piled up, one had a Gemara Malacha, one didn't. Now, that idea actually is consistent with an idea the Ramban presents in his Perush on Chumash. The Ramban suggests, I don't know what his conclusion, if he has a definite conclusion, that it might be that Minat Torah, the only thing that's obligated in Trumas and Maaseros, is, aside from Dagan, is wine and olive oil, not grapes and olives. If you, according to the Ramban, it's possible that if you just want to eat them as grapes or eat them as olives, midoraisa yinachayv in Trumas HaMaaseros. It's only when you actually process them. Okay? And that, now, so that's what's chayv in that Torah, Dagan Tirshra Yitzhar. Now, regardless of whether the Ramban is, and that, by the way, would make sense, why Dagan? It's not Tivua, it's not Tua, you know, Anofim and Zesim, it's Dagan Tirshra Yitzhar. Now, one of the rules in separating Trumas HaMaaseros, there are different stages. Before the grain reaches a third of its growth, if you harvest it, you never have to separate Trumas HaMaaseros, it's not really considered machal. Once it grows a third, if you harvest it at that point, there will be an obligation, whatever a third means, however you calculate a third, it will be it's called Havo'as Shlish, and for each fruit and grain, it's maybe a different amount of time and so on. After that stage, if you harvest it, you will eventually have to separate Trumas HaMaaseros. But while it's attached to the ground, you cannot separate Trumas HaMaaseros. It doesn't work. Once it is detached to the ground, you are first able to separate Trumas HaMaaseros, but you are not obligated to do so yet. You are only obligated to do so once you have a Gemar Malacha, once you have processed the food. And what that means on a Derabbanan level is that before Minat Torah, you could eat whatever you want before you finish processing. Midrabanan, they prohibited achilas keva, but they allowed achilas arai. Achilas keva means really making it a suda, your food, and so on. Achilas arai means nashi. And animal eating is always considered achilas arai. Achilas behemah is called achilas arai. So up until the Gemar Malacha, you are allowed to eat achilas arai from the produce. Once you have a Gemar Malacha, then you're not. It may be that it's still only nisa derabanan until you bring it into your house, what's called re'ias p'nei abayis. But once you have a Gemar Malacha, you finish processing the grain, and you bring it into your house, re'ias p'nei abayis, re'ias p'nei chatzar, now it's tevel midoraisa, and if it's one of these three produce in Eretz Yisrael, in a time when Trumas HaMaaseros is doraisa, if you eat from it, Kohen or Yisrael, without separating the Trumas HaMaaseros, yichai misa b'dei shamayim, for eating tevel. So for our purposes, that's a sort of basic outline of Trumas and Maaseros, right? You can't separate it until it's harvested, until it's talush. Once it's talush, you can separate it before you process it, but you don't have to. Once you process it, you can no longer eat anything from it until you've separated the Trumas and Maaseros. So the question is, when does the liquid that oozes out of grapes become wine so that you can no longer eat from it achilas keva? Can't achilas arai anymore. In other words, if I'm stomping in the grapes and I stick a cup in the middle of the grapes and I scoop out some liquid, that's not wine. That's not chayiv in Trumas HaMaaseros. Forget what it might be, and it could be, as we're going to see, it could be it's wine for the purposes of Yayin Nesach, but it's not wine for Maaseros, and it doesn't have a Gemar Malacha. So the question is, when does the wine become wine? When the stuff goes down, flows down into the pit, so there's still a lot of dregs, there's a lot of stuff in it, so you might have to filter it. Before you filter it, is it considered wine or not? So coming back to sort of the original question, what is wine? So it may depend upon when does something become wine? When does the liquid of grapes become wine? Well, that may depend upon what the halachic issue that you're talking about is as well. By means of another example, nobody would say that if I squeeze a grape in the field, let's say I take a grape and I give it a nice squeeze and some stuff oozes down onto the grapes, that's not going to be wine for Yayin Nesach purposes, but it could be wine for a different reason, which is, let's say I'm glad about that liquid, then there's something called Hechsher L'Kabel Tumah. Foods are not Mekabel Tumah until they have a liquid come upon them when they have been detached from the ground, with intent or post facto desire of the owners of the grapes. of the owners of the produce, excuse me. So obviously almost all produce has liquid get on it when it's attached to the ground. That does not make it mukhshar lekabel tuma. But once you detach it from the ground and then it gets liquid on it and you're glad, either you put it there or it got there but you're happy about it, so then the food is now mekabel tuma. There's an entire mesechta, not all of it is actually about it, but that's ostensibly dedicated to this topic near the end of Seder Taurus. It's called Meseches Machshirin. The way the Rashbam describes it in Chumash, it's like a gemar malacha for food. Like when you you wash the apple, so now the apple's an apple. That's, I think, the way he kind of gives the analogy. But whatever it is, the Torah, that's what the Torah says in Parsha Shemini. We'll read it right after Pesach. It gives us the rule of Hechsher. What kinds of liquids are Machshir? There are seven liquids. Yad, Shach, Adam. I don't care about the other six. The first one, Yud, is Yayin. So when Yayin gets a point, when you put Yayin on something and you're glad that it got there, you put it there on purpose either way, so then that thing is now susceptible. So if you are squeeze out the grape in the field, it's probably not yayin nesach. It's not a problem of eating the yayin, but it's going to be likely the machshir, the grapes that it fell upon. If they were detached from the ground, then amuksharim lekabel tuma. So the question is, what is wine? It may depend on what context we're talking about. Obviously, the primary context we are concerned about in our sugya right here is for the purposes of yayin nesach. Okay, so let's just read the Mishnah. And the Mishnah says as follows. Lochin gas beuta min ha'oved kochavim. Afal pi shehu notel biyado v'nosein l'tapuach. I'll translate the three. They look like three phrases here. V'eino osa yayin nesach ad sheyere labor. So the Mishnah says three things. If a goy has pressed, he has stomped. His boet usually means with your feet. Stomped in this area where the grapes are, and juice has oozed, wine has oozed out, or grape juice has oozed out, you can buy that from the guy. That wine, on the thresh, in the, I don't know, not threshing is not the word, but in the stomping pit, that wine is not yayin nesach. You can lochem ba'as gas ba'utam and ha'ove kochavim. Remember, presumably you can drink it as well. That's what we should. When we say lochem gas ba'uta, it means it's not, it's certainly not aser b'hano. If we're aser b'hano, you won't be allowed to buy it. You couldn't sell it, and you can't buy it. So you're allowed to buy that from a guy. And now, the afa pisha notel nosein biyadav nosein tapuach. You might have thought, well, it's just because the guy is only touching it with his feet. But if he touched it with his hands, let's say, out of this muck of grapes and wine, he picks up the big pieces of grapes and he puts them on the tapuach, right? This pile of what's going to be, you know, garbage. So even though you're still allowed to do so, and now there are two gersos here, but it appears the correct gerso is with a vav. There, some have a shin here, she, but we're going to read Tosfos says it should be a vav. Rashi has a vav. Ve'eino osa yayin nesach ad sheyered lebor. And on top of which, it does not become yayin nesach until it reaches the bar. Which really, what's the issue here? Well, the stomping receptacle, whatever you're stepping is up here, and then there's a hole, let's say, and it flows down into the bar. The question is, when does it become yayin nesach? When it leaves the vat? When it leaves the threshing? I gotta get a word for that. I don't know.
It is a vat.
Two vats, okay, fine. The stomping vat or the collecting vat. So when it leaves the stomping vat, but it hasn't reached the bottom, is it considered yayin nesach yet? So the last line in the Mishnah, especially if it's a vav, it's a third statement, ve'eino osa yayin nesach ad sheyered lebor, that probably means until it actually gets to the bottom.
Basically, it's using the word... Using the word nesach twice, because dinsoch from one vat to the
other. Oh, yeah, no, I don't, but that, yeah, but nobody, I don't think they're thinking about that question. Now, realize that one, there's a crucial issue that arises here, which is an issue that the Gemara will talk about somewhat later, about the question of nitzo kechibor. If the wine in the collecting vat is yayin nesach at that point, now, firstly, there's an assumption there, probably. The guy, except for Rashbam's opinion, at least in Tosos, most of the opinions assume that it's not that when it reaches the bor, it's automatically yayin nesach. A guy has to touch it there. But the point is that if a guy touches it on the way down, on the stomping vat on top, he doesn't make yayin nesach. And as it might be, he has to get in the bor, and then he has to touch it there.
Right.
Rashbam, Tosos we'll see at the end, I'll probably look at next week, says that no, it doesn't become yayin nesach until it reaches the bor, but if the guy stomped on it on top, when that, even though he doesn't touch it at the bottom, when it gets to the bottom, it becomes yayin nesach.
So
So whether you need one action or two actions.
Right, well, knows whether his koach, it's going to be an issue in this, whether his koach, even though he didn't touch it with his hands or whatever else, actually has an impact on the bottom. But the question, nitzo kechibur, is the following. Let's say the wine on the bottom is yayin esach, and it's connected by a continuous stream that's flowing down. This is a famous debate between the Sadducees and the Pharisees in the area of Tumah Vatara, and the question is, the Pharisees said it's not tame. It's not considered touching. The bottom, which is tame, is not considered touching the top, and therefore the top remains tahor. But the question is, what is the din by yayin esach? Do you say nitzo kechibur here, or not? So that's a question that's going to emerge from this. In other words, Yorad the Bor Masha Babo Arsav Hashem Mutter sounds like the stuff on top, you don't say Nitzo Kechibor. Okay. So we will stop here, and next week we will resume and we'll sort of start to get into all the details. There are two stages. This was the original din, then it was a Mishnah Achrona that changed the din, and they were more machmir in some things, they will make on certain other things. We'll get to see that, God willing, next week.